Welcome to your weekly Constitutional radio show about the Constitution, brought to you in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, we got no choice. All the girls and boys making all that noise, 'cause they found new toys. Well, we can't salute ya, can't find a flag. If that don't suit ya, that's a drag. School's out for summer. The second in a series we're doing called Facebook, Public Schools, and Free Speech. And in the first part of this series, we started our very fascinating interview with a fellow by the name of Frank Lomonti, who is the executive director of the Student Press Law Center. And that's a nonprofit legal aid organization that serves the needs of student journalists nationwide. You know, the editor of your school, high school newspaper, if he gets in trouble, if he has a problem, he might very well call Frank Lomonti. Now, Frank's been working in this area for a number of years. He knows all about the First Amendment, how it impacts these issues, and how it has to be balanced with competing issues of bringing up children properly in the schools and captive audiences and schools and all of these things. And in the first part of our interview, Frank told us, he sort of gave us a broad overview of the history of the most important school press cases in Supreme Court history, and he brought us right up to the Hazelwood case. Now, the Hazelwood case is actually what prompted Frank to contact me in the first place. Hazelwood is now 25 years old this year, and Hazelwood is probably, one might say, the latest and greatest explanation of the rules that the Supreme Court is going to follow when it evaluates whether a student paper gets to publish what it wants to, on the one hand, or whether the school gets to stop it, on the other. And at the end of our last episode, Frank was just telling us about the facts in the Hazelwood case.
The Hazelwood case was decided 25 years ago. It's a 1988 ruling by the court, and interestingly, it was a light bench. It was a bench that was down to 8 members of the court. This was the Robert Bork controversy year, the seat that Justice Kennedy would eventually, in time, come to be nominated for and to hold. But at the time, it was a light bench of 8 justices. And just to sort of set the scene in Hazelwood, what was going on? This is the one and only high school newspaper case ever to get to the United States Supreme Court. There was a high school in the St. Louis area, Hazelwood East High School. The newspaper was called The Spectrum. The students there decided to write a package of stories that probably by contemporary standards in 2013 would look pretty tame and pretty run-of-the-mill to us, but at the time were considered kind of racy. There was a story about what it was like to be a child in a broken family where the father had divorced the mother. There was a story about teen pregnancy. There was a story that referenced contraception, and it was kind of a big package of stories about social issues that were of concern to teenagers. And one of the stories interviewed anonymously some young women who had been pregnant, talking about that experience, talking about their contraception use or lack of use. Another story interviewed the students from broken homes. It anonymized these students, but in the principal's view, did not anonymize them sufficiently. He felt that an alert reader could probably figure out which families were being talked about here, and he was concerned about that, and more broadly was concerned that some of the content was just too mature for the youngest readers in high school. And so he calls up the printing company and tells them, I want you to yank those 2 pages out of the paper, and the paper comes out missing 2 pages. Well, the student editors, being aware of their rights under the Tinker case, take the school to court and challenge them under the First Amendment, saying, look, this content was not disruptive of school. It was the funny part is it was actually based on an earlier package of stories that the students had seen in a newspaper two or three years earlier, and they were really just doing an updated version of something that they were able to demonstrate had already run without any disruptive effect on their school.
Oh, okay.
So they take the case to court and lose at the district court level. The district court finds that this is constitutionally unprotected speech. It goes up from there to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, one of the regional circuit courts that that sets precedent for its member states. The Eighth Circuit reverses the district court, gives the victory to the students applying a faithful application of the Tinker case, and that takes us to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And what did the Supreme Court do in Hazelwood?
So the Supreme Court comes back. It's a split ruling, 5-3, again with the light bench. And in the majority ruling, Justice Byron White writes the majority ruling and says that we're going to now recognize basically two tiers of speech in school with accompanying levels of protection. And Tinker is still going to be the rule for individual expression. That is, words on your T-shirt, words on your baseball cap, words that are very clearly your own personal expression made using your own personal money. And then we'll have another tier of expression for what's called curricular speech. And curricular speech, Justice White tells us, is now going to be subject to a greatly reduced level of First Amendment protection. If you are using a curricular vehicle that's provided by the school, that might be a newspaper, it might be a yearbook, it might be a school play, it might be a school concert, if you're using a curricular means of communication that is provided and subsidized by the school for an educational purpose, then you will have only the most minimal level of First Amendment protection. In those instances, the school can censor what you write as long as they can point to what the court calls a legitimate pedagogical justification. The court will only step in, Justice White says, if the censorship is completely lacking in educational basis.
That's important, because when the court announces a rule, then of course that becomes everyone's focus or every lawyer's focus. So at least when we're talking about the so-called curricular speech, if the school can articulate a legitimate pedagogical justification and can simply say, we think this is going to be disruptive, we think this is an inappropriate story for the age group in question, we think this is not sufficiently anonymous, that's it. Basically, they're going to defer to that unless there is, it's patently clear that there's nothing there.
Right, and the court even gives kind of a laundry list of what might qualify as a legitimate pedagogical justification, and it talks about speech that's poorly written or inadequately researched or biased in some way, or, and this is an important one, something that in the court's view that associates the school with a position on a political issue. In other words, might be taken by a reasonable reader in the community who picks up that paper or picks up that yearbook or goes to that performance, might be taken as the official speech of the school staking out a position on a matter of political controversy.
Oh my goodness, they're treating it like government speech.
They really almost are. I mean, that's very, the court has never come squarely out and said that they believe that the students are speaking as agents of the school. And in fact, there's quite a good body of law that students are not agents of their school. I mean, after all, they're not, you know, they're not paid. They're required to be there. It's not a matter of choice on their part. So it's really that body of law is not an exact fit, but it's very analogous to it. It really does sort of, in my view, I think incorrectly, because I think the reasonable reader who picks up a high school newspaper does not actually think that an editorial is the official speech of the school, and certainly not one that's in some way criticizing the school or taking issue with a school policy. But be that as it may,
it's kind of funny. You know, on the one hand, I can see that. I can see that it's completely unrealistic for anyone picking up a school paper, which by, you know, for heaven's sake, at least back in the day, they were pretty easy to identify as a student production. They were pretty amateurish, many of them. And seeing a student editorial and thinking somehow that represented the school's opinion, I mean, that does seem rather silly. for anyone who's even thinking about it. On the other hand, since many people in the community are aware that schools exercise a lot of control over these things, they might think at the very least the school approves of it in the sense of having let it be published. And so that I can see both sides of that argument. And, you know, it's not always logical. It's not always logical. I recall back in the 1970s, there was a great brouhaha at my own high school when a local parent found out that we had just chartered a new thespian society. And was irate as could be because she didn't think that we should be approving lesbians. Now, clearly, she had not paid very close attention to what a thespian was or what, you know, parents, members of the community tend to get a bit emotional when it comes to children. So I guess I can see both sides of that question. But on the other hand, as you point out, you know, students are not the agents of the government. So that is a bit striking that the Hazelwood Court would treat this almost as governmental speech.
They really did. I mean, this is an outgrowth of this idea of forum doctrine, which is kind of a shorthand for the way that the court has developed over the years to analyze speech using government property. You know, if you want to speak out on the sidewalk or on your front lawn, or you know, using property that either belongs to you or that's held open to the general public for their wide open indiscriminate use, then one body of law applies. But if you want to use a piece of government property where it's somehow a scarce resource, it's not open to all comers for people to use indiscriminately for any old expression that they want to engage in, where the government has to sort of ration access to this property in some way, then the Supreme Court has developed this idea of a forum that we're going to let the government actually pick and choose sometimes among speakers or among speech in a way that we never would let them do on a public sidewalk or in a public park if they're having to ration access to, let's say, this newspaper they've applied this to things like the mailboxes in a school where people want to stuff them full of leaflets and things like that. If there's a scarce resource where we've got to allocate the time and the space, then the government does get to engage in some picking and choosing. And that's sort of the underlying idea of Hazelwood, is that we're going to let the government have a freer hand with regulating the content in this vehicle than we would ever let them have on the sidewalk or in a wide open expressive vehicle.
Okay, and so that's the curricular tier of speech identified in Hazelwood, but I think you also said that the other tier was the Tinker tier, the black armband case tier, and supposedly the rule in Tinker still applies there, that individuals are going to be allowed to pretty much express themselves except when such expression becomes disruptive and inconsistent with the educational mission of the school.
Right, and we see the Tinker rule still has force and still has vitality and has been subsequently reaffirmed by the Supreme Court as good law, as the law of the land.
So Tinker still is good law.
It's absolutely still good law. The Supreme Court told us so, and the only other student speech case we haven't yet talked about, a 2007 case called the Morse versus Frederick case.
The bong hits for Jesus case. Yes, indeed.
Unfortunately, a case that's doomed to be known for the frivolous message of the student speaker.
All right. Well, let's talk about that one. Let's talk about that case now, just to complete our case law, at least the major cases here, and then we can continue. Please, what happened there?
The Supreme Court doesn't have any other occasion from 1988 all the way up to 2007 to weigh in on speech in the K through 12 context anyway, until Morse versus Frederick. That's their next time that they wade into that body of law. And in Morse versus Frederick, as you say, the bong hits case, you've got a young man up in Juneau, Alaska, who decides that he's going to have his little 15 minutes of fame at an event where the Olympic torch is being run through Juneau, Alaska, as part of the relay that always crosses the globe. Juneau is going to be on the national TV news for this fleeting moment when the torch passes through downtown. The school decides this is a big moment in Juneau's history. We're going to let all the students be released from school and gather, congregate together on the hillside across from school, where they will all wave and cheer as the torch goes by. And so the student decides that he and a couple of his buddies, at that moment when the TV cameras are focused in on them, are going to hold up this kind of a hand-scrawled bed sheet where they've written on it this nonsense message, "Bong hits for Jesus," and that's going to be his way of having a laugh and getting on TV.
I'm sorry, Frank. I just have to pause there and say that once again, I can imagine several people in my high school class who would have done something very similar given the opportunity to do so.
Sure.
And as you say, it was a nonsense message, wasn't it? Didn't really advocate anything.
No, I mean, and when he was asked why he did it, the only thing he could articulate was that he thought it was funny and it would get him on television. It wasn't that he was trying to embrace any kind of particular position of any sort. That he was just going for laughs. His assistant principal's in the crowd is shocked and appalled by this.
Of course,
grabs the banner, takes it down, tells the students they're going to be punished, and the student Joseph Frederick decides that he's going to challenge this under the First Amendment. Feeling that, first of all, that it's probably not even a school speech case at all. After all, he was across the street from school. It was a day off from school, so he wasn't within the confines of the building at all. And then even if it was a school speech case, that he still should win under the rule of Tinker.
That's very important, and I was curious about that. Now, I know he was released from school, and the idea was that he'd stand out there, you know, and cheer things on, but was he required to be there? Was it a field trip? Was he being supervised?
Well, it was interesting. So the Supreme Court sort of fudges that. They blurred the edges of this a little bit. They come up with this idea that the event was school sanctioned, as they call it. So it was, while it was a release day from school, everybody was sort of expected to show up. It was a school encouraged event, even though it was considered an official release day from classes. And there was a certain amount of school imprint on the event. You did have administrators there organizing things and keeping order and keeping track of the comings and goings of the students, and they gathered everybody together to act as a group, and it was in fact right across the street facing the school, and so the Supreme Court's opinion, written by Chief Justice Roberts, just goes right ahead and says, look, based on all of those factors, we're essentially going to equate this to a field trip, and we're going to call this school speech. We consider that there's enough of the school's signature all over this event that, for all intents and purposes, he was speaking at school, and therefore our school speech cases and not our cases about real-world civilian life speech are going to be the cases that apply.
And that's extremely important, because if this had not been a school event, if they had said, no, you're released from school, he's standing on a sidewalk. He's just walking down the street, and that is classic traditional public forum. He would have had the highest protection for his speech.
Sure,
and the government would have had a great deal of difficulty restricting him in any way, and that really was sort of striking. I mean, you have a government official, the assistant principal, coming over and literally taking the sign out of their hands and telling them, you shall be punished. I am the government, and I am going to punish you for speaking on a sidewalk in a public area. So this is a very significant First Amendment distinction, and it's also very significant in this area of law, because you have, maybe without a lot of analysis or justification, the court has expanded the boundaries of the school beyond the brick and mortar of the building and beyond even an official field trip. And so where that boundary exactly is, I think, is going to be very significant in later cases, isn't it?
I think that that's right, although I have a tendency myself to see the Morse case as really a very sharply limited case that applies to an event that carries the imprint of the school. I think it's really a mistake to take it as a broader invitation for the school to start disciplining the conduct of students in any setting off campus on their personal time.
But
as
people are going to use that.
Attorneys would would have you believe.
Yeah.
But it certainly does not, in my view, throw the gates open to a wide open school authority over everything that students say in any context on or off campus. And there's a very forceful accompanying opinion, a concurring opinion, written by Justice Alito and joined by Justice Kennedy. And Justice Alito really tends to be a very doctrinaire guy when it comes to the First Amendment. He really is a true believer in the First Amendment, and he very grudgingly joins Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, saying, look, I'm okay going here, but not one inch further. I am joining this opinion. I am signing on to this opinion on the understanding that this is the furthest boundary that school authority will reach. And so given that those two votes, the Alito vote and the Kennedy vote, were the decisive votes in creating a majority for the Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, I think if you're a person who cares about student rights and is concerned that they have some uncensored time that belongs to them when they're not under the thumb of school authority, that you can take a lot of comfort in Justice Alito's words that this is where the line goes and no further.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Frank Lomonti about Facebook, public schools, and free speech. We haven't gotten to the Facebook part yet, but we're almost there. It's just that we had to prepare the ground first, because this is a complex area of law, and the Supreme Court hasn't always been consistent. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and we'll talk more with Frank Lomonti of the Student Press Law Center. Stick around.
I was on Facebook the other night, and I saw that I had mail. So I went to check my inbox to see who it was, but it wouldn't tell.
Man, I miss this Facebook girl. I miss this Facebook girl. She didn't show me her name. I thought she was playing silly games.
Once again, it's that time for our constitutional quiz, and here with us via Skype is the brand new quiz mom, Kelly Carmichael.
I love quiz mom. That's great.
Absolutely. Well, you're not just the quiz mom. You are the quiz mom, in fact, because I believe that young Madeline is once again with you.
She is with me. You never know. She may make her radio debut today.
We're all waiting with bated breath for that inevitable day when she makes her presence known.
Exactly.
All right, Ian. Who's our contestant today?
This is Ian from Knoxville, Tennessee.
So, Kelly, do you have a really hard question for Ian today?
Of course, Ian. Motherhood has not softened me one bit whatsoever.
I'm so glad to hear that, because, you know, I was worried you were going to go a little soft on us, get a little weepy-eyed like some new moms do. But no, just let's go with sock it to Ian.
All right. All right, Ian, are you ready?
I am.
All right. The constitutional protections found in Miranda versus Arizona are based off the interpretation of which amendments?
Which?
Is it A, the Fourth Amendment, B, the Fifth Amendment, C, the Fifth and Sixth Amendment, or D, the Fourth and Seventh Amendment?
Oh, man. So first of all, he has to know what Miranda versus Arizona involves, and then he has to figure out which one of those amendments it's based on?
Yes.
That is a tough question. That's a two-part question. Well, I'm going to fill in a little bit of the blank. Well, actually, I'm going to look at Ian. I'll tell you what.
Okay.
If you can answer this question now, you could win two T-shirts.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, because this is really a two-part question. But if you need me to tell you what Miranda versus Arizona was, then we can actually get to the answer choices. And then you just, it's just a usual quiz with one T-shirt at stake. So do you want to go for two or just one?
Well, I feel pretty confident about Miranda. In fact, I think most people that have watched crime movies or TV have heard cops talk about Miranda rights.
All right, Kelly, you heard him. He's going for two.
There we go.
It's just like the Vols going for a two-point conversion. All right.
But can I get the choices one more time, though?
Okay. Could you read the question again, please, Kelly?
Sure. We're talking about Miranda versus Arizona in 1966 and what constitutional protections are based off of what particular amendment from that case.
Okay. And what are the answer choices?
A, the Fourth Amendment, B, the Fifth Amendment, C, the Fifth and Sixth Amendment, and D, the Fourth and Seventh Amendment.
Ian, you're on your own.
Okay. Well, I know Miranda basically says you have a right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used to you in a court of law. You have a right to an attorney.
Sounds like he's heard these Miranda rights before.
not personally, no, not personally. I've seen them on television.
I'm hearing the theme to Law and Order there, yeah.
I know.
I think I'm going to go with the Fifth Amendment.
The Fifth Amendment. Which answer choice is that, Kelly?
That was B.
Okay, now why do you think that it's just the Fifth Amendment?
Well, you certainly have a right to a jury trial in criminal cases, and in federal cases, even a grand jury has to indict you. So
jury trial, does that come from the Fifth Amendment?
No. Wait, was there a Sixth Amendment also as a choice? I thought there was only Fifth.
I think there's a Sixth. Is there one that has the Fourth? What are they again, Kelly?
I'm sorry, we're confusing it. A was the Fourth Amendment, B was the Fifth Amendment, C was the Fifth and Sixth Amendment, and D was the Fourth and Seventh Amendment.
I didn't hear that second part. We'll go with C then.
C, the Fourth and Sixth Amendment?
No, the Fifth and Sixth.
Fifth and Sixth Amendment. I can't keep them straight myself. Okay.
Fourth, Fifth, Sixth—they're all the same, right?
You want the one, whichever it was, that said the Fifth and Sixth Amendments.
That's correct.
Okay. Now explain to me why you think it's both the Fifth and Sixth Amendments.
Well, my reasoning is you have a right to a jury trial, and if memory serves me correct, that's the Sixth Amendment.
Okay.
Because the Seventh Amendment is that peculiar one that talks about trials at least $20, and then I want to say the right to counsel, although it's not explicitly stated, I want to say it's in there.
Okay, so you think that's also in the Sixth Amendment?
What about the Fifth
Amendment part?
The warning, you know, you have the right to remain silent. I think that would be lifted from the prohibition against self-incrimination, which is, of course, we are familiar with pleading the Fifth.
Oh, okay. So the right.
That's my thinking.
This contestant has some background knowledge here.
Okay. So right to remain silent, that comes out of the Fifth, and the jury trial and the right to counsel, you think, comes out of the Sixth. Did I get that right?
I think that's correct, yeah.
Okay, and that is answer choice D, or excuse me, C, right, Kelly?
C, that's correct.
Okay, so is that the answer choice you want?
I think that's it. I'm going to stick with it.
You're going to stick with that, and you didn't want the Seventh, which you said has to do with those $20 civil jury trials.
Yes, I believe that's correct.
And you didn't want just the Fifth or just the Sixth for the reasons we've just discussed.
I wanted the Fifth and the Sixth, yeah.
All right, I think we finally nailed it down. Kelly, did we all get it? I mean, I hope we're all stating it correctly now. Did Ian answer the question correctly?
Ian, I think you did a fantastic job. Congratulations.
Oh, man, we have our first double T-shirt winner.
Double T-shirt winner.
I have to ask, Ian, congratulations, by the way, but who are you going to give the second T-shirt to?
Or maybe he'll just keep it and cycle both in and out of the laundry.
I guess he could.
I don't know. That's a tough decision. I'll have to think about it.
You don't have a sweetie pie?
Well, yeah, and I think she would be very, very angry with me if I didn't give it to her.
Oh, okay, all right. So Ian and his sweetie pie are both going to get YWC T-shirts. Tremendous.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you, Professor.
Well, thank you very much, Ian, and thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Frank Lomonte, who's the Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. And we've been discussing the important cases that define the limits of student free speech. One of the limits, and this is one of the things people often overlook, is the actual physical boundaries of the school. Do the rules differ depending on whether the students are actually at school or not at school? Or is it not that simple? Maybe the boundaries stretch a little bit beyond the school walls? That's exactly what Frank and I are talking about, or what we were talking about before we took our break. Let's rejoin our conversation now. For this case, for the Bong Hits for Jesus case, for the Morse case, they decide that this is a school event, and so they're going to apply school law, they're going to apply Hazelwood, they're going to apply Tinker, whatever they're going to do. So what do they do? What do they decide in this case? Does this kid win, or does he lose?
Yeah, so what they decide is they sort of fashion, as they did with Matthew Frazier's case, they sort of fashion this one-off exemption where they say, well, Tinker still applies and Tinker is still good law. So they reinforce and they reiterate that Tinker remains the law of the land. But there will be a recognized exception when speech promotes the use of illegal drugs, that illegal drugs are such a uniquely dangerous threat to the physical safety of students that we are going to let schools punish that kind of speech, even if it doesn't rise to the disruptive level that would otherwise make it punishable under the Tinker rule.
So they've created a special drug rule.
An exception to Tinker.
It's a drug exception to Tinker.
It absolutely is. It's a content-based drug speech exception to Tinker. And importantly, I should say, both the majority opinion and a very well-written dissenting opinion both recognize that it would be a much different matter if the student had held up a banner which said, I advocate legalizing marijuana. If he had held up that banner, that would be political speech addressing a matter of public concern. And what the court has told us time and time again is that that type of speech is entitled to extra strength deference under our First Amendment. And so the school could never punish the student, even if they took that to be a pro-drug message, because it would be a message of political speech addressing itself to a public controversy.
Well, that's interesting question you bring up, because you're right. That kind of core political speech and that kind of viewpoint is the most protected type of speech under the First Amendment generally. But one might argue, and I'm sure many people on the other side of this issue do, that the Morse case has blessed exactly that type of discrimination, because the schools are not going to care if someone says, don't use illegal drugs. You know, dare not to use drugs or whatever anti-drug message. In fact, I'm sure many schools give those things out and have anti-drug rallies. But the instant that somebody has something even as vague and strange as Bong Hits for Jesus that might theoretically suggest that drug use is okay or that it's funny, that's who's going to get disciplined. And that is viewpoint based on a matter of very important public concern. And that seems to be what they're saying. And that's what makes Morse such a troubling case.
It's a very dangerous line to cross if you start to legitimize viewpoint-based discrimination. One of the things that the Supreme Court has always told us about the First Amendment is that it's almost never going to be permissible for the government to pick and choose among viewpoints. It's almost impossible to construct a situation outside of the school setting where the Supreme Court would ever say that the government can make one viewpoint but not the other on an issue of public concern punishable or could forbid its expression.
Extremely troubling, not just from that perspective, but also from the perspective of the educational mission. We go all the way back to Tinker. What are we teaching our students? I remember years ago, it was the late 70s, I'm in high school, and I had a public speaking class, and I think I was a junior or senior at the time, and the subject in question was, should we legalize drugs? And that we got up and we made speeches pro and we made speeches con. I mean, that was the whole point of the exercise, and the idea that you'd have such an exercise and put certain viewpoints off limits is anathema to the very idea of education.
Well, and when you begin to countenance viewpoint discrimination, the ultimate risk that you run, and as an advocate for journalists at the Student Press Law Center, this is the type of speech that we are most concerned about protecting, is what I would classify as whistleblowing speech. That is, the student who wants to publish the news article or the editorial in which they're calling attention to a shortcoming in school policies or school programs. The student who wants to to write the opinion column saying, look, the abstinence-based sex education curriculum in this school is a joke. It's not working. It should be discarded. Nobody takes it seriously, and it's ineffective in preventing teen pregnancy, and we need to start over with a more balanced and better reasoned policy. I mean, that's the kind of argument, frankly, that ought to be had in the pages of student newspapers and in the hallways, leaflets, at rallies and at assemblies. That's the kind of viewpoint that ought to be welcomed and invited, because that's good information for all of us. That's good information for parents, for policymakers to have. That's valuable input.
And I seem to recall.
To allow viewpoint discrimination by schools, you at least open the door to the possibility that they might be able to say, look, it's fine, Johnny, for you to talk about sex education, but only consistently with our abstinence-based policy. And if you countermand or contravene our abstinence-based policy, if your speech undermines that policy, then we're going to use our authority to forbid it or to punish you for what you say. And that's an incredibly dangerous proposition, and one that just undermines the idea of schools as a place to teach civic participation. The idea that somehow the government gets to tell you when it's okay to disagree with them is really a noxious idea, and one that all of us should reject.
It's a very troubling idea, and of course I think it defines the difference between education and indoctrination. On the other hand, that is not an opinion that's universally held. In fact, I seem to recall that Justice Thomas especially is rather dismissive of First Amendment rights in a school context, isn't he?
It's really, Justice Thomas has a very unique perspective on this that fortunately is not shared by anyone else on the court. Justice Thomas really is the ultimate constitutional originalist. And in his view, he goes back to the 18th century, and he goes back to the notion of students as being, as young people, as being sort of personal property of their parents, chattels, pieces of furniture. And if you view young people in that way, if you view children in that way, then in his view, there are no constitutional rights for young people, and therefore the school has a free hand to censor at will. That's an interesting historical take, but it's an incomplete historical take. If you go back to the time of the Constitution, you go back to the 18th century. While it's probably true that people wouldn't have recognized First Amendment rights for young people in schools, number one, school was at that time mainly provided by churches and not by the government. And so I think that's a fairly unremarkable proposition that you have no First Amendment rights against your church. That's not subject to debate. I wouldn't disagree with that proposition. The other is that school was done after about 6 years. You were graduated. That was all the school you were ever going to get. And so the idea that an 18-year-old a high school newspaper editor or an 18-year-old person might be treated as an infant, treated as a person who was incapable of being trusted with the Bill of Rights, I think really would have been quite laughable in Thomas Jefferson's time, because by the time you were 18, by golly, you were married and you had a job and you had maybe kids of your own and you were running your own farm. You sure as heck weren't in a public high school.
Okay, well, I think we've covered most of the major cases that have been decided by the court, because the court doesn't decide that many school press cases or speech cases. What are the current issues that are making their way up through the courts?
Well, it's very true, and it is worth noting that we don't have a lot of guidance after Hazelwood about the meets and bounds of the First Amendment as it regards student journalism. Those cases just don't go to court, and then there's two reasons why they don't go to court. One is that certainly after Hazelwood, it's become such an uphill climb and such a discouraging road for young people that it's actually discouraging for them to even try to take it on, and it it's quite difficult to get an attorney to invest the time that it would take to wage that uphill battle. The other thing is frankly, when you are a journalist, your time scale is not measured in years. Your time is measured in days and hours. And so the idea that you might somehow get a moral victory handed to you 2.5 years after you graduate is not really a meaningful vindication for a young journalist. And so journalism cases really tend not to go to court, and therefore the First Amendment rights of young people are being written in other contexts in ways that have spillover impact perhaps onto journalism but are not themselves journalism cases. And those cases disproportionately today tend to be cases about speeches on social networking sites.
It's your weekly Constitutional. We're talking about Facebook, public schools, and free speech. And we have finally, we've gotten to the issue of social networking sites. But first, let's have a brief break and have our Madison Minute.
America did not invent the concept of a Bill of Rights. That honor goes to Great Britain. Understanding how Britain's Bill of Rights developed is necessary for understanding why there was a controversy over whether or not to add a Bill of Rights to the United States Constitution. Both the defenders and the detractors of that proposal drew upon the British tradition to support their positions. The staunchest defenders of an American Bill of Rights could rightly claim that the British counterpart had been an invaluable security for the rights of both Englishmen and Americans. But the opponents of a Bill of Rights, initially including James Madison, could rightly claim that the political conditions that made a Bill of Rights necessary in Britain were very different from the situation in America, where a limited and wholly popular government had been created by the people themselves. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blalock.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. After the break, we'll have our This Week at Montpelier, and then we'll return to our discussion with Frank Lomonti of the Student Press Law Center all about Facebook, public schools, and free speech. So stick around.
There's an online world where I am king of a little website dedicated to me, with pictures of me and a list of my friends and an unofficial record of the groups that I'm in. Before the internet, friendship was so tough. You actually had to be in people's presence and stuff. Who would have thought that with a point and a click, I would know that Hope Floats is your favorite flick? Harry Connick Jr.
Well, Kelly Carmichael, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
Well, at Montpelier on Saturday, February 16th, our good old Gilmore Cabin is open once again from 12 to 5 p.m. And it's a free tour of the cabin where you can go learn about George Gilmore, who is a slave born into slavery in Montpelier in 1810. Mm-hmm. And you get a chance to visualize his life that he built for his family after emancipation. So you really can tell quite the story of our country and the Constitution just by visiting his house from a man who was in slavery and then earned his freedom later on.
He was actually still alive, wasn't he, when the DuPonts bought the property? If he was born in 1810, he would have been awfully old when they bought it, but he was not long in the ground before, and his descendants were still there when the DuPonts bought Montpelier in the early 20th century, I believe.
That's correct. And the tour will focus on the struggle for African Americans during Reconstruction and the Gilmore family's eventual ownership of this particular land, and just, you know, general discussions about citizenship and the role of citizenship over our U.S. history.
That's a very inspiring story. And I have a confession to make. I have been all over Montpelier, but I've yet to visit the Gilmore Cabin.
Goodness gracious, well, we'll have to get you there.
I am going to get there. Now, in my defense, it is across the road, and so you have to make a conscious effort to go across and see it. And, of course, it's right down the street from the 1910 or 1911 train station, which is also part of the Montpelier estate.
But that gets into more of the Jim Crow era.
Right, segregation and everything. Well, I'm going to go visit them both, and this would be a good time to do it. So thanks for letting us know, Kelly.
And I should add, too, that while you're there, right next to the Gilmore cabin and Gilmore farm, our Civil War trail will also be open.
Oh.
So folks can go take a look at some of the Civil War encampments and walk in the footsteps of McGowan's brigade on our Civil War trail.
Lots of history all in one place. Thanks so much, Kelly Carmichael.
Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're talking about Facebook, public schools, and free speech with Frank Lamonti of the Student Press Law Center. Let's finish up our conversation now.
Do we allow schools to extend their punitive authority over that kind of speech even when the young person is not in the school building, is not using school facilities, is not holding themselves out in any fashion as being a school representative, and yet the speech might potentially be viewed or might have some spillover reaction at school?
So schools are actually trying to punish students for saying, you know, I think our principal is a jackass, and saying it on Facebook. The student sitting at home, Facebook obviously exists somewhere out there in cyberspace. It's completely outside the school. It's in the student's downtime. It's on, you know, it's on a Saturday afternoon or maybe in the middle of summer break or something. And student and the school still want to punish students for that.
Yeah, we're really seeing a wave of this. There was a little boomlet of this back in November, right after the election, when a number of citizens, both young and old, I might add, this is not a not behavior that was limited to young people. A number of citizens decided to use the First Amendment in a very unproductive and uncivil fashion by going on Twitter and calling the newly reelected president very bad names. There were a number of articles written about the incivility on Twitter toward President Obama, and this resulted in a number of schools actually tracking down and hunting down the student operators of these Twitter accounts and punishing them for essentially using racial slurs toward the president, even though there was no jurisdictional nexus to the school. It was just sort of a generalized bad behavior, uncivil behavior, and a number of schools around the country asserted that they had the authority to punish that behavior, that essentially they could use their disciplinary authority to enforce good citizenship upon you because your speech was potentially viewable at school.
Yeah, that's a troubling thing. On the one hand, certainly we don't want to encourage any student to use racial epithets, obviously not. And by and large, generally, yeah, we want our schools to encourage good citizenship and good civic participation by students. But nonetheless, that's fairly concerning, isn't it, when schools are reaching into effectively the students' pockets and their, you know, their iPhones or into their bedrooms where they have their laptop computers and trying to regulate that as somehow related to the school. And I guess that's where a lot of the litigation's taking place now, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's worrisome in two respects, and I have to disclose a little bit of my background here from the vantage point that I'm coming from. I mean, I come from a family of educators, and my father was a guidance counselor and assistant principal in a really tough New York school for most of his career, and was sort of the biggest guy on the administrative staff, and the biggest guy is always the person who's put in charge of discipline, and he was the designated disciplinarian for his tough New York high school. And my dad, who was a combat military veteran and a really mean SOB,
Sorry, Dad.
Ever. My dad almost never uncorked the authority of suspension or expulsion short of a student actually acting out in a violent manner. He was an educator, and he believed that the mission of the school was to educate. And I think the idea that somehow in order to teach you optimal behavior, in order to teach you to function as a good, productive citizen, we need to be able to expel you, really shows just a profound failure of imagination and creativity by the education system. I don't know how you can make that logical leap to say that in order to prepare you to be a successful citizen, we're going to kick you out of school. it seems like we ought to be doing everything in our power as educators to keep you as part of the school community, but to bring you around using our educational resources and not our punitive ones. So it's certainly worrisome from that perspective. And then just more broadly in the message that it is sending young people, it's really worrisome and troublesome. We just had a symposium back in November at the University of North Carolina in which we were focusing on the 25th anniversary of the Hazelwood ruling. And there was a speaker who's the head of the journalism program down at the University of Arizona, Dave Coulier. And Dave made this really memorable statement that just crystallized so well exactly what the stakes are here when he talked about the condition in which young people are coming to his university after graduating from the public school system. And he talked about the fact that they were coming into journalism school having been trained to be, in his words, sheep, being trained to be so compliant to government authority that they believed that the government could tell them what to say, what not to say, that if you criticize the government, you can get in trouble for doing that, and that it is a bad thing to say things that are controversial or that people might disagree with. And in Dave's words, the journalism school was having to retrain and reprogram people with remedial constitutional values to undo the damage that was being done to them in the public schools. And that's just a tremendously sad and worrisome commentary that our public schools, instead of preparing people for active citizenship, are actually damaging them.
Yeah, it's an interesting and difficult circumstance. We go right back to where we started. I mean, you know, on the one hand, yes, we want to teach our children values, and in some sense, that is indoctrination. You teach a child that it's wrong to steal. You teach a child that it's wrong to kill. You teach a child any of the other basic tenets of morality, and in one sense, yeah, you're telling them what to think. But to a great extent, we also want to teach them how to think and how to make up their minds for themselves. That's an important part of education, too. And that seems to be where we keep ping-ponging back and forth. And it's interesting to me, as I've been listening to you describe these problems historically and currently, how the court's decision seemed to parallel society. You know, back in the 60s, whenever it was all peace, love, and flower power, students' rights were at the fore. And then subsequently, in the 80s especially, when we were a much more conformist society, much more conservative society, the cases went exactly the opposite way. And now, and who knows where we're heading, which direction we're heading now, but now isn't it interesting that we're debating these issues right on the very fringe, and the new technology is going to point the way for the future of this balance. And I don't know which way to predict. What do you think? What's your prediction, Frank?
Well, I think that's very well observed. You really can, I'm sure this analogy has been used many times in the law, but you really can plot the development of student First Amendment rights like the swinging of a pendulum. You can see the pendulum swinging toward freedom, toward individual liberty, and against government authority back in the 60s and 70s, and then you can see it thereafter pulling much back toward the direction of conformity, toward deference to policymakers and rulemakers, and much less toward individual liberty. And we've seen that play out in some other aspects of the law as well, notably the rights of criminal defendants, the rights of people against illegal search and detention. But yeah, and so now what we're seeing, and I've referred before to my student journalists, to the young people that we represent, as the dolphins who are caught in the tuna net. And I think that's an apt description of where the rights of young people are right now, that because of the focus on cyberbullying in particular, because schools are so concerned, and rightly so. I share this concern that young people are being victimized by uncivil speech using social networking sites and using the tools of technology, that we're in a period of a very heavy-handed disciplinary crackdown that unfortunately has an intimidating shadow over legitimate editorial commentary and discussion of public issues that do belong in school and that are the proper province of our educational system. You know, it is one thing to say that a young person ought not engage in racial slurs. I think we can all agree that that's deplorable behavior and that we would condemn it, whether it's coming from a teenager or coming from our next-door neighbor. But it's another thing to say that you also can't have a spirited debate about something like affirmative action or immigration policy or the rights of same-sex couples to marry, because somehow that might hurt somebody's feelings, and hurt feelings are the threshold to cyberbullying. Well, you know, the Supreme Court actually told us in so many words, going back to that Morse versus Frederick case, going back to the Bong Hits case, Chief Justice Roberts actually told us that offensiveness is not a reason to punish speech. It was really quite interesting. The school in the Morse case tried to convince the Supreme Court that they had authority over any speech that was offensive. And the Supreme Court rejected that idea. The liberal and conservative alike rejected the idea and said, look, there is speech about politics and speech about religion that people might find offended, and yet that's what the First Amendment exists to protect. And we're not going to let you, the school, which after all is the government, go quite that far. You know, here's what I think is going on in the realm of student online speech. The first generation of cases, and it's funny to have to speak in terms of generations, but they've been so compressed now by the evolution of technology.
Yeah, the cases from last week and the cases from next week. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Right. I mean, generations of legal cases are now like generations of iPods. Right. There's a new one coming out every year. And so we have a first generation of cases that took place when the internet was really brand new to the courts, and they looked at online student speech using the web as being entirely outside of the jurisdiction of schools. They looked at it like speech on a public sidewalk, and it was sort of laughable to them that the school could extend authority over that unless the student actually did something to physically bring the speech inside of the school. You know, if I went to the school computer and I called up the website and I called my buddies over and I said, get a load of this website, now I've brought the speech into the school and now the school might be able to punish me. But if I don't do that, if I just use the internet at mom's house on Saturday, that was considered initially to be outside the punitive authority of the school. Then we had the boom of Facebook and of Twitter following that, and we had this national round of publicity accompanying some very, very heart-wrenching cases about young people losing their lives after being targeted by cyberbullies, and we went into a period of extraordinary backlash by regulators and by the courts, where you've now seen the courts are willing in many cases to extend the Tinker rule and to say that speech is governed by the Tinker standard no matter where it takes place. And so if the school can show that some disruptive behavior occurred inside of the school in response to the student's speech, it doesn't matter where the speech took place. That's the position of at least two of the judicial circuits, the Fourth Circuit, where I'm located in Virginia, the Eighth Circuit has said as much, and a couple of other circuits have taken a more equivocal position and have said, we don't really know what the answer is, and we need the Supreme Court to tell us. Back in the 2011 term, there were several petitions for review in front of the U.S. Supreme Court of cases just exactly like this, cases where a student was disciplined for speech on a social networking site, and the Supreme Court declined to hear any of those cases. And so, frankly, we now have kind of a muddle in that area of the law. We have cases pointing in different directions. We have the Fourth Circuit and the Eighth Circuit telling us that, yes, Mr. Principal, yes, Mr. Superintendent, you may discipline speech on Facebook or on Twitter if you can show that it rises to the level of a tinker disruption. We have the Third Circuit based in Philadelphia saying, to the contrary, we're not at all convinced that tinker applies because this speech is just qualitatively different.
And that's our show. Thanks so much to Frank Lamonti of the Student Press Law Center for speaking to us about Facebook and public schools and free speech all the way back to the Tinker decision in 1969. It's a convoluted area, but it's very important and very current. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Larry Mayer. Carol Hutchinson does our scheduling for us. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.